one of the things that I always approach leadership from is, how do I make engineers who are working with me the most effective and the most innovative in their life?
Welcome to the RH Podcast. We talk about business, software, and everything in between. Visit us at www.recursive.house, where we build software for large and small businesses. Hello, Lumia. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you for hosting me.
No problem at all. I'm going to introduce you. So today we're talking to Lumia Yusuf. She has over 13 years experience in the software technology industry. She's been a project manager. She's been a general manager. She's been a software engineer. She lectures at Stanford. She's been a manager at Facebook. And now she's director of engineering at Apple, continues to be a visiting research scientist at Stanford University and board member at Illuminate. Did I get all that right?
The only difference is I am not at Apple anymore. I exit from my role at Apple. Nonetheless, you got the rest right. Yes.
Well, close enough.
Very cool.
Okay. So I think you've done so many different things and it's interesting to figure out where to start. But I think I'll start at where most people can probably feel some sort of closeness, which is, I think, academia. I think most people have had at least some level of education. So one of the things I think a lot of teachers wish is that people come to school to specifically learn something. But if you're in school for quite a while, you probably had that intention. So could you tell me a little bit about sort of what you were looking to learn when you were in school? Because I think you reached quite a high level of accreditation. And what was really like driving you? What was the questions driving you, you know, to sort of continue to push forward at the edge of sort of your knowledge base?
That sounds good. Thank you, Hato, for the excellent introduction. Really looking forward to this conversation today and uncover some of the things that I've done, but also some of the lessons that I learned throughout the journey and be able to connect with the audience. So to answer your question, I am originally from Egypt. I came from Egypt to the US about 2 years ago to study computer science and to closer to the Silicon Valley. And one of driving missions and driving intentions of why I came all the way from another part of the world, far away part of the world, is to be able to bring technology to useful human use cases. So how do we connect the technology that we're developing today with the tools that we have in order to be able to improve on our life and to be able to improve on day-to-day activities? Right. When I came here to the US, one of my goals was to study artificial neural networks back in the days. And a funny story is when I was applying to different grad schools and basically, you know, like writing my research statement, the feedback that I got was, it's a dead field. Don't go there. Nothing going to happen in artificial intelligence. And you're going to be wasting your life. Of course, you know, like we know now, that's a very different story. But back in the days, that was the perceived value of what artificial neural networks could do for us. Having said that, so I asked, why is it the case? I mean, basically, one of the most important questions that each and every one of us should always ask is why? And the reason was the lack of the computational resources. So I was like, let me solve this problem first. Let me work on this problem first before diving more into the AI application to human use cases. Right. And that's what I did. So started by working on virtualization for hyper-performance computing through my graduate degree at UC Santa Barbara before going to MIT and work on large-scale operating systems for the cloud. And it happened that it was at the heart of everything that was happening in a new emerging field at that time, which was cloud computing. And I just found my work at the heart of everything that was happening. So wrote this paper. Actually, this I just checked a few months ago. It has about 5,000 citations, which is, you know, like from an academic point of view, is very impactful on what is the cloud. So why do we need a cloud? What are the different components of the cloud? How do we put it to a good use? But one of the things that was always bothering me when I was in academia is that I don't have the view of how end users are using the technology and using the capabilities, the technical capabilities that we're building, that we're exploring, that we're, you know, basically thinking about in the academic field. So we build an operating system for the cloud. How would users use it? What are the gaps? What are the applications? What's the killer application for this kind of operating system? And that's what or why my journey took me from academia to the industry, where I joined Google in the early days of Google Cloud, where I was able to work directly with consumers, work directly with end users, in this case, enterprises, in order to understand how are they putting the cloud into useful use cases for their workloads and for their day-to-day business.
Okay. So, I mean, what sort of in the arc of that story, what seems to hold consistent is that you really wanted to know why people are using technology, what they were using it for. You're very interested in that. So I want to ask you, what did you initially think the use for AI was or machine learning was when you first started? So what really sparked that particular kind of interest? Because at that time, like you said, it was not a popular idea that this was even possible. And you know what has happened in the last 10 years, 15 years has been very interesting. But what in the world made you think, hey, I'm going to make a computer think?
Absolutely. I remember very well a class that I've taken in my undergraduate day in the American University in Cairo that was very impactful on, again, artificial neural networks. And at the time, one of the homeworks was about designing a neural network, a predictive neural network that can predict breast cancer, benign or malignant behavior. And that's just basically using some data, being able to build on this data in order to be able to find the behavior of the disease and whether, and this is one of the most famous homework examples that we teach today in artificial intelligence, being able to put it into a useful, very hard to solve by human use case and being able to use the machine in order to assist the human and to be able to save lives later on. During the time, my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. So of course, you know, like it came very close and it was very impactful in terms of, so can you use really machines in order to be able to solve such a very hard medical problem? Luckily and fortunately, my mom was diagnosed very early and she was recovered and she's recovered. And basically, you know, like seeing how the technology could have helped many more people at a scalable scale definitely left a very strong impact on me.
So, I mean, I think that's basically, first of all, a fantastic sort of transition into the industry because it gives you a lot of agency and I think that's really amazing. So you sort of divided that problem into two. First was actually being able to scale the problem, right? Being able to scale the technology, which is something that you directly went into doing, and then obviously the artificial intelligence problem itself. So let's talk a little bit about just sort of that scaling part and some of your challenges there, and then some of the things that you thought were interesting and some of the interesting challenges to you that you solved and on and on. So if you don't mind.
Absolutely, 100%. So scaling neural networks or deep learning, as we call it today, continues to be a challenge in the industry and continues to be a challenge despite seeing how powerful and impactful the scalable models get us. So as you probably know, GPT is a very powerful model today, and the more parameters that we have for this kind of neural architecture, the more powerful, the more impactful, the more responsive the model becomes. So basically being able to scale it to the next level became one of the biggest challenges that we look at today and become one of the most powerful things that we can do for this field. I remember when I started, one of the things that basically this specific homework, the benign versus malignant disease, one of the challenges was designing it using C and pointers, because these are the tools that were available now back in the days, and designing it without much libraries rather than with doing the very basic C libraries, because that was also the state of the art. And one of the things that we have done effectively over the years as a research field and as a group of practitioners is we raise the level of abstraction for how we're providing our users, in this case, the users are machine learning engineers, machine learning practitioners, with a more effective and scalable frameworks and to be able to develop, monitor, debug, and scale machine learning to the next level. So, for example, one of the things that comes to mind is the frameworks have came across in the last several years, I would say 5 to 10 years, in order to make the process a little bit more simpler, PyTorch and other frameworks that came in this field that basically raise the abstraction level from a library point of view to the next level in order to be able to remove the friction that we used to have back in the days. Nonetheless, there is a lot of remaining gaps in order to be able to take it even to the next level. One of them, for example, is how do we do scalability? How do we scale the machine learning model for training to the next level such that we are able to basically feed more data, feed more information to the system in order to be able to leverage the capabilities that can be provided at kind of scale. I'm very impressed by one of the systems that recently, I would say in the last 3 years, came from UC Berkeley, the Ray framework, that basically allows this kind of scalability by combining together what we know about high-performance computing and MPI and the libraries that we have been using for, I would say, 70 years today with the capabilities that we need and the gaps that we see today in machine learning in order to scale it to the next level. So basically what I see, to summarize, is we're raising the abstraction level one step at a time. There still continues to be a significant gap in the market. Nonetheless, I'm very excited and very can't wait to see the progress that we make, especially from a machine learning operations point of view in order to take the field to the next level. And I believe that today and now is the perfect time to do that, especially as we're finally at the point of showing the capabilities, showing the impact, and showing the innovation that we can drive from machine learning, driven by the excellent tools that have been basically given at the hands of end users through ChatGPT and through similar tools that the community have built over the last 6 months.
Right. So, and that's one thing that's very unique about machine learning. So the field, it's accelerated so fast, and it's amazing to see what they've done. Sort of in my mind, you split it in sort of into two parts, even though there's many steps. But the first was making it so that the C libraries could be sort of could be abstracted a little bit. And I think you said something about pointers, basically, that you're dealing with that.
That was in the very early days. So the ability to abstract anything. Again, that's, about 20, 25 years ago when, basically we didn't have any tools to do any neural net. I remember designing my first neural network or this model that's basically, also this is going to date me to some extent. It's basically, on floppy disks. And in order to parallelize it, I had to copy the same model into different floppy disks and then borrow my brother's computer, borrow my dad's computer in order to run it overnight, hoping that one of them is going to converge and one of them is going to get me to the right. This was the way that was available to us back in the days in order to tune and to train the model.
And so mostly the issues were pointer issues, just like no pointer exception issues. And that was enough, that just having that abstraction layer, like wrapping in CPython, was enough to just like increase to how fast people can actually create these models. And that was really, really it?
Yes. And having the libraries, having higher abstraction levels, having the parallelization, integrating, having the different tools to be able to basically auto-tune the model, the search space in a more efficient way, advance the field much faster in order to be able to arrive at the result much faster. Nonetheless, we still are not there. There is way more capabilities that are needed and more gaps that are needed, specifically around machine learning productization in real applications. And that's one of the biggest gaps that exists.
Right. And the search space optimization is probably just, improving the statistical models you guys are leveraging to actually find the solutions for things. Is that sort of what you guys were doing at that time?
It was more of basically building everything that we need from scratch. That's the point that I'm trying to drive, which is basically we didn't have the tools. So basically we build the components, neurons, and weights between neurons using C components or C abstraction level and data structures. We define the data structure. We define the connection between the different neurons using pointers.
Right.
So you can imagine, how hard it is to debug.
Of course.
Whenever we have a faulty pointer or, a pointer that's pointing to the wrong or the non-existent memory location, then, things would take fault and we have to restart the computer. That was the debugging level. So basically that was what's available to us back in the days.
We're talking about the D-Ray, is it D-Ray or Ray system that you are very impressed by for the new
Ray
system? So what do you think that they're doing with high performance computing optimizations that you might be giving them the advantage that you're very impressed by?
Absolutely. What they are doing is that they're building an abstraction level that brings together the intersection of two fields. One of the fields is high performance computing field, which is very efficient in terms of parallelizing and scaling different codes at the high level of scalability.
Right.
This field have been very effective in terms of building scientific codes for the national labs. So back in the days, that was the most scientific, the most scalable way that we can do computing for large scale problems. And at the same time, taking that and applying it at the machine learning level, at the machine learning codes level, in order to be able to enable the practitioners of machine learning codes and practitioners of machine learning folks to be able to write scalable code and take it to the next level from a scalability point of view.
Okay. So
sound reasonable?
I'm interested in what those techniques are, I guess, to some degree. So unless you've already told me and I missed it, but what those techniques are that they were able to leverage to actually supersede what we have now. So you talked a little bit about scalability and things of that nature and then so we're able to scale now. So we're able to eat as many resources as possible now as we want to we can do that, improve what each individual resource can do. And that's what Ray is supposed to be able to do. And so sort of looking for what that piece is. if I'm asking the right question.
So the best analogy to look at that is comparison between what we used to do and what can we do today through high performance computing capabilities when added to machine learning field. So back in the days, we would write different small components for different applications, scientific applications, or
quantification.
Let's think about matrix multiplication and optimize it per machine, and then go all the way level down to optimize the computation that you want to run in each computational unit and optimize the communication. Because if you're doing a lot of computation, but the communication is lagging, then your whole application is lagging, and the other way around. So being able to optimize computation versus communication for the specific application running at the specific level of the code becomes a challenge and becomes very time consuming. And therefore, it delays the progress of the whole project.
Right.
What happens computing field have done over the years is being able to define higher abstraction levels in the form of libraries, in the form of ways to basically methods and techniques, and tactics, in order to be able to parallelize this code and manage this kind of communication, computation ratio at the higher level in order to be able to improve the productivity of users. There are several techniques over the years that have been done in this field, such as message passing, such as basically shared memory, and so on. So this is one of the things that's really impressing me with how Ray, the Ray library, is using this deep knowledge of learning to be able to deploy today in machine learning. Machine learning, at the end of the day, will boil down to matrix multiplication, sparse matrix multiplication. So how do we leverage the knowledge that we have from high performance computing and combine it with the needs that we have today from machine learning in order to be able to accelerate the field and accelerate the development of different machine learning models in production.
Right.
Does it answer your question?
Yes, it does. Basically, you're creating unique components, high performance computing created unique components for different purposes. So you're leveraging that idea, leveraging the ideas of sort of high performance computing so that it fits primarily with matrix multiplication at different tiers of computation all the way down to, I suppose, the chip, but just basically almost doing what you did initially where you were, you know, building your perceptrons from scratch, but now you're sort of building it from scratch with matrix multiplication in mind. But it's not just the perception, it's the perceptrons, it's actually the units, the computational units, the actual chips, things like that. So D-Ray has been able to sort of move down that stack, move down that layer. It's sort of what I got from you, if that, you know.
You love it. You summarize it much better than I did.
Well, you started, so I had, you know, I got a bit of a primer. So, okay, so I think that's really interesting, sort of seeing your perspective on this and also sort of your experience and how you sort of climbed it. It's very interesting to actually hear someone say they were doing machine learning on a floppy disk. I think that's something I would have expected to hear. So I think that's, you know, I can imagine the frustration of having to drop like that.
I'm sure I have the floppy disk somewhere back in Cairo now, in my desk somewhere.
Well, you know,
very frustrating. Very frustrating.
So I know, hence, you're like, listen, let's see how we can abstract this, because I can't keep having this problem. Okay, so
speaking of abstraction, actually, one thing that I want to note over here is if you look at the progress of computer science as a field and as an industry, technology and software engineering as an industry, you will see that over the years we always progress. We always come from one idea to the next, and from one impact to the next, and from one era to the next, through raising the abstraction level. Whether it's in the programming field, whether it's in the compiler field, whether it's in the operating system field, or whether it is in some of the applications field, including cloud and including AI. So, for example, in cloud, we used to have all of the machines back in the days, and you can combine the machines yourself. Right. But at one point, by providing API that's abstracting where are the machines and what kind of machines running under the virtualization level and how it's running, and you provided a higher abstraction level that basically simplifies the whole process, such that we as technologists can focus on the next problem and be able to scale it to the next level.
Right.
So abstraction, or raising the abstraction level, is a common theme for progress in our field in general.
Right, absolutely. It's essential, you know, to sort of box out concerns so you have space for the next. Human minds can basically do 5 to 7 things at one time. So if you can push that, you only have space for innovation when you actually have space to think about it. So I think, time is of the essence when it comes to building things. And if someone can solve a problem for you, it gives you more time to really push that. And
very true.
And speaking of pushing needles within the context of scale and simplifying things and abstracting things, you were, in terms of the industry of sort of distributed computing, very instrumental in providing a functional tool called Kubernetes. And it'd be great for me to hear a little bit about sort of what you did there and some of the challenges there. And also this is one of, I think, your opportunities to bring a team together to really push towards a goal that allowed for you to build an abstraction layer that allowed people to, you know, get more space, you know, to push things forward.
Absolutely, 100%. So one of the things that I find myself very lucky to contribute to and to work with early days is when I moved from MIT to Google. 2011, Google Cloud was just starting, and I got to work with Beda and Craig McLaughlin in Google Cloud Seattle, where we were just maybe 12, or at the time the team was about 12 or 14, working together in order to build the very basics of what cloud computing at Google would look like, so GCP and GCE, and was very quickly, they interested me by contributing very quickly to some of the basic components in GCE. So I remember working on the startup script for different VMs and optimizing the startup component for the virtual machines that we all use today, and optimizing the time it takes to start a VM on Google Cloud, and the encryption disk for this kind of computational loads that are being now used by millions around the world. So definitely this kind of gave me the very basic understanding of where the complexity is, and it was just a great learning experience. But again, being driven by being closer to the user, being driven by understanding where the connectivity between the technologies and technical capabilities that we're developing and the capabilities and how the consumer is using it at the end of the day. So I moved to the product management function within Google Cloud. I am part of Google Cloud Storage. Continue to think along these same exactly lines of how do we raise the abstraction level to the next idea.
Why did you think that project management would allow you to do that a little bit more than even getting, I'm assuming you weren't as hands-on in project management. It might not be true. But what is it about that role you said, hey, look, this is where I'll be able to really push that initiative forward of making sure that the end user has what they need, even though you lose the power to actually contribute concretely per se. So
one of the things in the product management is how do you connect, start with the use case, start with the gap, the market gap, and how do you connect it back to the technical capability? So being driven by user needs and being driven by user gaps is the main goal for various, you know, like efforts in product management. Despite having very little influence, if I may say, or very little authoritative influence on different engineers, but you still have the influence, or what we call is management by influence on the different engineers to be able to convince them to implement the different ideas. But being close to the end user, to the customers, is where most product managers, good product managers, would thrive, because having a deep understanding of where the end user is needing different capabilities, or is struggling, or is finding the gap in the system, is where they can define the technical capabilities and then convince the engineers to be able to implement it and to be able to basically build systems that's going to be of use in the end today to the consumer. However, having said that, one of the things actually before we basically move on from this point on product management is when I got to be a product manager at Google Cloud and got to work with end users, consumers, one thing that was quickly clear to different users and to different product managers is consumers want to build cloud capabilities on different clouds. They don't want to be locked into one cloud through the technical capabilities that's only available to one cloud. And they want another abstraction level, back to the abstraction level idea, that kind of high the level of implementation inside the different clouds and be able to use some kind of a super cloud that's provide them with the capabilities they need without having the lock-in basically advantage to one cloud versus another. So at the time I wrote this patent with the help of Google lawyers and with the help of Google folks around virtualization of virtual machines. In other words, next virtualization level that sits above the virtualization. Independently, at the same time, the Kubernetes team was thinking about what Kubernetes look like and how do we implement it in reality by building this next virtualization level for the different virtual machines. And my understanding is that Google used both efforts, the patent as well as the actual implementation of the code, to be able to get to this market and to be able to build and scale Kubernetes to the next level and be as impactful as it is today in the market.
So what was the challenge? Forgive me for saying abstract. I guess the audience should forgive me for saying abstraction twice. But what was the challenge in abstracting? You know, VMs are virtual, and abstracting that is another layer. So is it just the sort of the engineering of integrating with so many pieces or creating sort of like an integration system that is standardizable, or, you know, so there's so many ways you can sort of think about how to make something like Kubernetes. But what was it that really, I guess within this context of abstraction, but what was it that really made it different? What made it unique where it could do this really quickly? Because Kubernetes came out like that, right? It would seem like that to the outside world. I'm sure many people were working on it for quite a while, but what made it unique in that way?
The main challenge with any new library or any new system is to capture the real needs of the user at the right abstraction level.
Right.
So if it goes too high from an abstraction level point of view, then it would hide a lot of capabilities from the user point of view, where it gets very difficult to optimize underneath it, but also the user would feel very little power in terms of controlling the system, very little power in optimizing it for their own use cases. Similarly, if it's at a lower abstraction level than the abstraction level that's needed, then in this case, the user would be overwhelmed with parameters, overwhelmed with capabilities that they don't want to care about. So this is only to tell that getting the right abstraction level at the right level is very critical, and that all comes from and is based on how deep of an understanding of the customer needs are and what's important to the customer and what not. And this is one of the things that I believe Kubernetes did very well in order to be able to capture the attention of the market when there was several other players at the time, basically doing something similar, but at a higher or a lower abstraction.
So with that in mind, you almost sort of what I'm hearing is you're engineering that tier at which the user is going to interface with your with the product or with the tool. And it, obviously, it's very clear that that product manager role really got you that influence that you needed to say, hey, look, this is where we needed to be. So is there something even within that where this is what really made that difference? Like, okay, here is where if we don't have this, then we will no longer actually, and sometimes it's a bit of a guess that the market just decides, hey, this is what we want, and you just iterate and iterate. But is there something that you remember is like, okay, with these capabilities, with this level of control, users were quite happy? Or did they tell you?
I remember specifically seeing a large-scale customer at the time who came to Google Cloud and that I was working closely with, who wanted to migrate away from AWS at the time, given some pricing dynamics, and was looking at what would it take to run their application across different clouds at the same time. And that use case was very impactful for me to see that today, or back in the days, it was a very difficult
challenge
to be able to such a system, let alone manage and let alone scale it and continue to productize it over time. And there was no availability in the system of other abstraction level, or other frameworks or other software that can help the user with such a use case. And it was also clear to me back in that time is this is, while this is the beginner, like while this is one of the users that we're seeing today, that's going to be continuous flow of users. They come because different clouds are developing different capabilities, and they differ between this capability or another. So if the user wants a specific capability in one cloud, but another specific capability that's not available in the first cloud, but is going to be useful to them, but available in the second cloud, they won't combine some of this workload, and they want to have the portability for their workloads from one cloud to another without being locked in, let alone, of course, the pricing, which is, you know, like basically because of the different pricing capabilities and pricing of different cloud capabilities across different cloud players back at the time. Basically, users may want to optimize their deployment on the cloud. So you, again, need to raise the abstraction level in order to be able to provide this level of abstraction or portability in order to be able to drive the workloads further and in order to be able to have a bigger impact in the industry. And that's what, again, I believe that Kubernetes did very well. And that's why it was very well adapted across different cloud providers as we see today.
Right. So just being able
Having said that, unfortunately, I wasn't able to contribute to Kubernetes as an implementation wise during my time at Google. I contributed to the patent. The patent was issued, and I'm very happy with that. But due to, you know, like me moving on to another role, I wasn't there for the actual implementation. The folks who did the implementation at Google did such an awesome job, and it just like created a lot of really good power to the consumer in the enterprise cloud that didn't exist before. And have such respect for what they did with implementation and taking it to the next level.
No, that's fantastic. And what I'm hearing is that you, essentially the idea of making it sort of platform agnostic with Kubernetes at that time was already enough to sort of push the initiative forward and really get that in the market and get people really excited about using it. But yes, there was definitely a big contribution in making sure it actually fit the market in and of itself. And that was your contribution. And those who sort of put code down have a lot to be proud of as well. I'd like to, you know, and thank you for bearing with me for zooming all the way in from a technical point of view, but I was just interested. But let's sort of zoom all the way out and talk about, there's a lot of big initiatives that you've been part of or tried to contribute to in different capacities. And a lot of that is bringing people together, making it so that they understand the goal and making sure they execute on a goal. Can you iterate that in smaller or larger cycles, depending on all kinds of concerns? So I guess one of my questions is that sort of what's your philosophy on leadership? What do you really see with some of these things that are actually quite hard to do? And I think your perspective on that is that you're really quite, a lot of people are saying they are at the edge, but you really are at the edge of something with a lot of things you've done, whether it be distributed computing, and then we'll probably talk about AI a little bit later, but you definitely are at the edge of that. So, you know, sort of what's your philosophy on leadership and sort of how do you make these things happen?
Absolutely. This is a good question. So philosophy on leadership. One of the things that I always approach leadership from is how do I make engineers working with me and teams that are working with me the most effective and the most basically innovative in their life and basically productive in their life. And this is usually my starting position. And my approach is through coaching. By being able to partner with different engineers and partner with different folks in my team, providing them with the tools, providing them with the capabilities, providing them with the insights, and sometimes even with the mental models in terms of how they can implement and in terms of how they can scale their own efforts and go to the next level, I find that this is usually the most effective way for leadership from my point of view. And I usually come from a growth mindset of, what can I do in order to make them more efficient, more impactful, more proud of the work that they are doing, as well as more clear and happy with their contributions nowadays, but also how can I help them get to the next level in their career? And at the same time, what can I learn from them the most in order to be able also to learn and grow myself? So finding the intersection between these two cycles and between these two capabilities and between these two intentions, usually I find it the most impactful for me from a leadership point of view.
Okay.
So summarize, it's based on coaching. It's based on how do I help engineers and engineering manager get to the next level, mm-hmm. and how do I coach them in order to be more effective and proud of the work that they are doing day in and day out.
Some of the things you talked about here, in fact, almost all of the things you talked about here have to do with scalability. So what I want to ask you is, when you approach a scalability problem from a leadership point of view, where you have, you know, let's say you had 500 people that you needed to make sure were achieving a goal, how did you distribute that load within yourself, within the 8 hours, 9 hours you had to make sure that things got done?
Absolutely. So a couple of things. Usually I approach any of these exercises as a team effort, which is, you know, like we work together as a team to be able to define where is the big picture and what do we want to approach and what we do want to achieve, mm-hmm. in a certain time frame, but also more specifically in terms of prioritization, in terms of what's the most important thing that we want to achieve, but also where are the stretch goals. And one of the frameworks that I usually rely on, whether in my professional life or whether in my personal life actually as well, is OKRs. I am a big fan of OKRs. I learned it in the days when I first worked at Google. Every month I sit down in the beginning of the month to write down what's my OKRs for this month, including defining what are my P0s and P1s and what are my stretch goals for the month in terms of, you know, like objectives, key results. And just at the very high level, what are your OKRs, the objective and key results, where you can define what are your objective for the different capabilities or what you want to achieve over the next time frame, as well as how do you break it down in terms of key results in order to be able to achieve what you are hoping to achieve, and in order as well to keep your focus and in order to continue executing in the way that you're executing. So OKRs have been very effective for me in terms of focusing on what's important and not distract myself with many things that's taking my attention. And just to tie it back the previous basically question, one of my main OKRs is to be able to coach folks who are work with me to be able to to the next level, and that's through delegation, that's through providing them with the resources, mm-hmm. that's through providing them with trainings, that might be through. So this is kind of, you know, like basically, even though my plate might be full, but there's only OKRs that are highest level focus for me, and helping others by seeing where they can focus their OKRs in order to get to the next level on their side as well.
Okay. So sort of taking all this in terms of leadership and things of that nature, which you've sort of been learning over quite a bit of time, but also because of some of the things you've done with Kubernetes at Google, and, you know, understanding user needs and bringing all those things together to push towards a goal and slicing those into OKRs. How did you, and at this time, you probably had already done quite a bit of distributed computing work and understood that sort of space, and actually even been part of a solution for that space. My assumption is from there, you're like, okay, let's go back to the issue, which is, let's see what we can do with neural networks. Let's see what we can do with machine learning. Let's see what we can do with artificial intelligence. So could you talk a little bit about that transition and that journey to go back to sort of the actual goal? And it must have felt great to say, hey, look, this foundation has been finally set. Leave me alone. Let me do the thing that I really wanted to do. Let's go.
Absolutely. One of the advantages, I would say, in our field is it's an evolving field. I always think how we compare computer science and software engineering versus history as a field, for example. And history mainly, you know, like, is set in stone to a great extent. There are a few historical events that happen nowadays that might update the field of history to one extent or another. There's a lot of research, there is a lot of deep knowledge, but it's not one that you can influence. And at this point, it takes more like in comparison, if you look at computer science, it's a field that's evolving by the day. We're very lucky to be, you know, like in the middle of things where things are, you know, like changing almost every month. Last few months, for example, in AI and machine learning is, you know, like a testament to how things have been changing very quickly. And that's exciting. But also that places a very important responsibility on us as practitioners and as academics and as software engineers and software managers in this field, basically around learning. Learning, to make sure that we're keeping up to speed, to make sure that we're allocating some of our time to go deep and understand how the innovation that's happening in different fields are, to the extent that actually if somebody like get disconnected from the field for a year, the amount of accumulation of things that they haven't learned over time becomes significant. Mm-hmm. So despite, for example, that initially I did not work in artificial intelligence when I first came to the US because of a lack of funding in this field at mm-hmm. the time, but I continued to be involved with that field one way or another, whether it's through attending seminars in the university, whether it's by building some of the basically use cases that can connect back to the same field. So, for example, one of the use cases that I remember very well building in 2005, 2006 in UC Santa Barbara was out from a class project on migration of the capelin fish in the Icelandic Ocean.
Okay.
And one would say, you know, how is that related to AI and how that's related to machine learning? Mm-hmm. But if you look more depth in terms of the behavior of the migration of the mm-hmm. fish, and so every fish is basically, you know, like interacting with different fish around it in 360 degrees, mm-hmm. and the way that a fish defines where it's going to move next is based on basically influence, mm-hmm. ocean influence, as well as other fish mm-hmm. influence, in order to make sure that they are moving as part of the shoal. And in the end of the day, every fish is very similar to a neuron, mm-hmm. where each neuron needs to apply a certain mathematical model in order to be able to move in a certain direction. Right. Having said that, the most interesting impact of this problem is if you take it from an economic point of view, the capelin fish is one of the most impactful and one of the most important economical resources mm-hmm. for Iceland. Mm-hmm. And the Icelandic governments wanted this model in order to be able to predict how the fish is mm-hmm. moving, in order to put policies around fishing and the fishing industry, right. because they don't want to overfish because it's going to impact them economically. They don't want to underfish because also it's going to impact them mm-hmm. economically. So being able to do that as a way of predicting how it's going to impact GDP is very important to them.
Right.
Taking the same model where every fish is becoming a neuron and being able to scale it to the next level, shoals are usually billions of fish, you know. So being able to map it to billions of neurons on the other mm-hmm. side and being able to scale it is basically the same kind of characteristic from a computational communication point of view.
Okay.
So being able to develop and work on this model back in the days when I wasn't able to work on AI and machine mm-hmm. learning directly was still connecting me with the field. Mm-hmm. And that's some of the knowledge that I still continue to apply today mm-hmm. in basically evaluating and analyzing and understanding the computational communication impact of different libraries all of different architecture, neural architectures right. in general.
Something that's interesting to...
Having said that,
go ahead. Yeah. No, so one thing that was interesting to me is like, so the migratory patterns to me would be quite, you know, what was the need for using something that would give you higher granularity in terms of the way the fishing patterns ended up being, it just sort of happened, right? Because I would assume, you know, the basic patterns is would be quite, I won't say obvious, but once you track, you know where they are. So what was now more, what was the level of granularity that was necessary or that would help better improve or better predict, you know, something about it, right? Because for me, the problem of overfishing or underfishing is simply about location and quantity and, you know, mm-hmm. sort of Absolutely. Relative to the shore and how easy it is to get. And then you just sort of optimize for that. But you're saying even understanding, having a sort of understanding of the patterns, you know, where, you know, the pattern of space that they actually shape basically of the group. Also has an opportunity for some sort of other optimization, which I'm not sure. So that's basically my question.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So the problem, I mean, the biological problem, this work was done in collaboration with a professor in the biological right. sciences and another one in the marine sciences, I believe, UC Santa Barbara, is there's no good understanding of how the whole school moves unless you study and unless you are at the granularity of pure fish.
Right.
And in order to predict how the whole shoal is moving in a certain direction or exists in a certain area around the Icelandic ocean versus not, in order to say, you know, like in this year, we can fish on this part or we cannot fish in this other part of the ocean. And then you need to understand how each shoal would behave.
Right.
And therefore, you need to understand how each will right. behave. And that's where the simulation level gets down to the fish and you need to simulate one fish at a time. And that's where skiing becomes a really critical component in order to be able to get it to the
extent. So they were having a hard time finding it. It wasn't as simple as here are some of the paths over time and on aggregate we know exactly where they were going to be. It was tough to find them. So having this model, there was sort of the sparsity of information and having this model better predict. I guess the parameters of this model are basically exactly. like weather patterns, and then you'd be able to say, okay, is it, you know, based on the way they generally behave relative to what we have, they'll, and based on the actual space of the problem, which is each individual's fish is 360 degrees, and on aggregate, all these fishes and all their sort of degrees, yes. they're going to be going in this direction.
Okay. You got it right. Yes, absolutely. And that's where, you know, like it becomes a scalability right. problem, and it becomes a mathematical right. problem in the end of the day, where you kind of, you know, like end up by sparse matrix multiplication right. between different forces,
right.
and you're trying to predict how the whole network of forces would behave in the end of the day, which is very similar to what we see today in neural networks and in training different
right. networks. So, you know, keeping up with all this and contributing to this while also sort of contributing to the ability for all this to be in the market. And then you got into the market with, or I suppose the market was, or you prepared the market for this. So, you know, what was the next project you did, you know, in artificial intelligence that was directly in the market?
Absolutely. Yeah. This one was high performance computing, scientific right. computing kind of project. We didn't use any machine learning back right. in the days, except that the model, it's very similar to what we see in today's sparse matrix multiplication
right.
that applies very closely to machine learning and large scale neural
right,
architectures.
Right.
From there, that kind of, you know, like continues to keep the thread of right. learning to different right. points in order to make sure that you stay up to speed. And I remember when we built the cloud operating system at mm-hmm. MIT, that at that time is called FOS mm-hmm. or FOSS, or basically third operating system, which is, you know, like how do we build a new operating system from right. scratch for new era of cloud? And what does it mean and how it's going to change the abstraction level again for right. the users. And we kept asking the same question, which is, what's the killer app or this new operating right. system? Who or what are the real workloads that's going to take advantage of this kind of new computational right. power that's going to be offered and available at a high abstraction level? And that's where my transition back to the industry happened, as well as where my transition back to AI machine learning, because it turns out that machine learning at scale is the computationally intensive workload that can take advantage of such a large scale system at scale, including cloud, including operating systems.
So just quick question with the FOS system. So my understanding is the fundamental assumption that this system would have, and this is just a guess, that this operating system will automatically be able to distribute the load between computers. Is that where, and then therefore there's an application that is able to sort of, you know, give you the workloads to this operating system, or leverage the fact that this operating system can do this, and then sort of make assumptions about the abstraction layer that makes it easy for the user.
Absolutely.
I'm just, you know, all right.
It is the question of if we were to raise abstraction level for the user above the cloud.
Right, right.
How do we define, how we redesign the whole stack below the operating system API, such that run natively on all of the capabilities beneath it, without, again, caring about or worrying about where exactly are you running and what are the capabilities of the hardware that you're running on at the operating system level, and optimizing all the way through the stack down to the hardware level and the interconnectivity between the different
components. Okay, okay. All right. So then, so you sort of took this idea, you were able to leverage, maybe not in an operating system, but as an idea where that consideration is sort of left alone. And so to give more space, like we talked about, for more cognitive load for other issues. So you took that idea and you brought that into a...
I took this idea and then gained more experience from building clouds, and took the same idea and then gained and built on it from building AI systems, where, again, you are raising the abstraction level in terms of how you're delivering the capabilities at the AI level from the components that might be very disconnected, however optimized for this specific.
So you were able to say, okay, relative to whether the Kubernetes thing or the product manager role was at Kubernetes, where you understood the right basic sort of abstraction layer that the user will be able to, will appreciate. You took the FOS systems abstraction layer that you researched and applied to say, okay, this is the right abstraction layer when we're going into AI solutions and tools. This is the abstraction layer we need for artificial intelligence models and things like that, or tools for artificial intelligence models. And so that's what you took. You just took that piece and applied it to the future products that you were a part of, if I'm getting it right.
Yeah, too. One thing to think about here is, if we are along the same thread of abstraction level, I mean, I'd love to get your input on this and the audience input on this. If we are raising the abstraction level one level at a time and by one industry era at a time, let's imagine how the abstraction level is going to look like in 10 years from today, specifically around AI and specifically around the computational resources. Right. What do you think? I'm curious.
I think it's really about, I think what these things are doing primarily are simulating reality more to some degree more efficiently using statistical models. So I think, you know, essentially the ways that we interface with these tools will become more and more natural to us as the tools are able to better, because they're able to better simulate reality, where we are going to use reality's tools to, you know, sort of interact with them. So all basically we keep rotating computational resources. If this statistical model mechanism continues, where the assumption essentially is that you're continuously making approximations and storing the results of these approximations, right? So basically those are the sizes. Basically what might happen would be the sizes of the storages of these approximations will reduce. They'll become more specialized into certain features of reality, you know, whether it might be visual or audio, or, you know, where the complexity of that unit, the complexity of what that unit is required to infer is higher, but the principle is the same. So a video card will be now required to do something much more powerful, but it'll still be a video card. So therefore it'll just reduce itself to those places. And, you know, sort of the distribution of those things will, I guess the distribution I think right now is what used to happen before, where we used to have big mainframes, but now we have mainframes. We're outsourcing the concept of mainframes and make it more accessible. So there's more just like accessibility of mainframes. So I think everything sort of rotates forward, but like all things in technology, just reduces in size and things like that. So I think that will eventually make, essentially we'll have, it would be a personal computer, but the way you would interact with it wouldn't feel that way. It wouldn't be keyboard, it wouldn't be mouse, you'd be speaking to it. Or like you said, the interface is a bit more loose. And I think it's interesting because what we found with machine learning tools is they're actually better at less precise communication. So there is a sort of, someone did this sort of comparison of machine learning, ChatGPT and Mathematica. So Mathematica can provide more accurate results, but you have to tell it exactly what it is. And then ChatGPT may not be correct, but you can speak to it in any language. So I think that's sort of, it's very loose. And no one's asked me this question before, but I think that's just basically from the computational side, what's going to happen. Obviously, reduction in size, increase in power. I'm more related to reality components. And then I sort of like maybe an increase in precision, maybe. But I don't even think that's as important to human beings, because the resolution of information for people in general, it doesn't have to be very high. It just has to be pretty fast. So, I mean, I don't know if that makes sense. You probably know more than me, but this is definitely just a guess.
it's very hard. I mean, if we judge anything from the last 10 years, it's very hard to predict where the next 10 years are going to be. Nonetheless, I would love to see they were. I can integrate machine learning capabilities into any products without having to go into depth of where it's running, how am I productizing it, what are the components that goes into it, what kind of model it is, how am I training, how am I, and just have the abstraction level of I have integrated an AI model into my component that's providing me with the capabilities that I need for my end user without having to care about anything underneath the service of this abstraction level, and basically have a very concrete and clear separation of concerns between this is the product and this is the product capability that I am providing to my user versus this is the machine learning operations and the machine learning capabilities that's being, you know, like provided underneath the service of the product. So that's what I'd love to see in the next 10 years. It's possible, but we'll live and tell.
Well, now that we know what you're going to be working on in the next 10 years, we want to know where we can reach out to you in the next few months.
Sounds good.
So if you don't mind, could you tell the people sort of where to find you, some of the things you're doing in the future, and just basically how to reach out to you or see what you're doing, because I think you're doing some really interesting things.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. So I'm always reachable on LinkedIn. I have a public LinkedIn profile where I keep my writings as well as keep sharing a little bit about what I'm doing and the different conferences that I'm contributing to or sharing, including a conference next month, March of 2023 in Cambridge, Boston, specifically around productization of AI machine learning, the CIO TTI Vanguard conference. Over there, I'm going to be talking more about what does it mean in building AI and integrating AI applications and machine learning applications specifically to enterprise workloads. Nonetheless, we'll be sharing a lot about the bits from these contributions on my LinkedIn. I'm always reachable at lyusuf at LinkedIn, as well as other platforms, and happy to be able to keep connectivity with the audience and be able of any help in any form or shape.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for sharing everything you've shared so far.
Absolutely. Thank you. Really, I enjoyed our conversation today. Enjoyed this with you.
Welcome to the RH podcast. We talk about business, software, and everything in between. Visit us at www.recursive.house, where we build software for large and small businesses.